Good morning, everyone. The Arizona Board of Behavioral Health Examiners will now come to order on September 6th at 9:01, 2024, at 1740 West Adams Street, Boardroom C, Phoenix, Arizona. Can I have roll call, please?
Robert Charles.
Here.
Christina Groves.
Here.
Lynette Hennigan.
Here.
Jose Luis Madera.
Here.
Adelie Samik.
Here.
Diane Palacios.
Hello, good morning.
Mark Shen.
Here.
Kristen Krieger. Crystal Krieger.
Here.
Thank you. My name is Adelie Samik. I'm a licensed professional counselor and licensed independent substance abuse counselor, and I'm the board chairperson. At this time, I would like to remind everyone to please make sure that your phone is on silent or turned off. For your convenience throughout the meeting, vending machines are right outside this room and the restrooms are across from the elevators. A couple of reminders, this is an open meeting and it is being recorded. The audio from the meeting will be posted on the board's website. Please be sure if you are speaking on the record that you speak clearly and into the microphone. In order to protect privacy, please keep in mind if it is necessary to refer to clients or former clients to use initials only, even if they are the complainant. At this time, I would ask my fellow board members and board staff to introduce themselves, starting with Mr. Charles.
Bob Charles, public member.
Crystal Krieger, professional member.
Mark Shen, professional member.
Christina Groves, licensed marriage and family therapist, professional member.
Diane Palacios, LPC, LISAC, professional member.
Lynette Hennigan, licensed clinical social worker and licensed independent substance abuse counselor, professional member.
Jose Luis Madera, professional member.
Jarrett Carver, enforcement manager.
Crystal McAsee, program project specialist.
Allison Taylor, operations manager.
Toby Zavala, executive director.
Mona Baskin, assistant attorney general, representing the board this morning.
Thank you very much. We now move to agenda item number 3 minutes. We have item 3A, May 10, 2024, general meeting minutes. 3B, May 10, 2024, executive session minutes, agenda item 7F. And item 3C, June 14, 2024, general meeting minutes. We have no quorum, so those three items will be tabled. Item 3D and 3E, Dr. Hennigan will abstain. And we have August 9, 2024, general meeting minutes, and August 9, 2024, executive session minutes, agenda item 12A. Do I have a motion to approve?
Palacios moves.
Do I have a second?
10 seconds.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Oppose? Okay, motion carries. The next item is consent agenda. Item number 4. Items on the consent agenda appear with a recommendation from board staff. Board members have reviewed all of the materials and the recommendations. We are prepared to vote on each matter as it appears on the agenda. Before doing so, I will call each matter to see if anyone here wishes to pull the matter. Pulling the matter means that you are a party to the matter, you do not agree with the recommendations, and you would like up to 5 minutes to address the board. If you do wish to pull the matter, please raise your hand when it is called so I can note that you are here. And I also want to let people know that board members can also pull the matters. All right, so agenda item 4A, cases recommended for dismissal. Item 1, Lisi Brown. 4A2, Shona Chesley Crow. Item 4A4, Kay Rema. 4A6, Marie Tuller. And do I have a motion to recommend dismissal for items 4A, 1, 2, 4, and 6?
Palacios moves.
Your seconds.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. I go back to item 4A, 3, and 5. Ms. Palacios recuses. Item 3, Jessica Hedgepeth. And item 5, Valerie LeGrand Stewart. Do I have a motion for dismissal, items 4A, 3, and 5?
Hennigan moves.
Groves second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. And since Ms. Palacios is still standing up, I'm going to move to 4B. Cases recommended for dismissal with a letter of concern. 4B2, Ms. Palacios recuses. Paulina Brook. Do I have a motion to dismiss with a letter of concern for item 4B2?
So moved, Shen.
Do I have a second?
Madeira second.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Ms. Palacios, you can join. Items 4B, again, cases recommended for dismissal with letter of concern. Item 1, Angela Bassett. Vermel Brown. Morgan Deflin. And Megan O'Neill. Yes. Are you Megan or are you the complainant? Okay, and you wish to pull the matter? Okay, you don't agree with the recommendations? Okay, you can come to the front, please. And let me take a vote for items 4B1, 3, and 4. Do I have a motion to dismiss with letter of concern?
Palacios, go ahead.
Figure your motion.
Hennigan, second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. You can go ahead and have a seat. We're going to go to item 4B2. No, 4B5, Megan O'Neill. One second. Okay, could you, you're the complainant, right? Could you state your name for the record? You can push the button to the turn screen. There you go.
It was on.
Oh.
Tiffany Dean.
Thank you. So first we're going to listen for a summary from board staff, and then you have up to 5 minutes to address the board.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the board, this matter was on the consent agenda based on following a review of the investigative record. There did not appear to be clear and convincing evidence to support a violation of unprofessional conduct. However, the board may want to consider dismissing the complaint with a letter of concern on the following. It is a professional's responsibility to ensure appropriate professional boundaries within the workplace. And that's all I have, unless you have any questions for me.
Thank you. Any questions for board staff from board members? No. Okay, Ms. Dean, you can address the board now. You have up to 5 minutes.
Preparing this speech today was very hard to do. Asking those she hurt to show up today was even harder. Em's actions has deeply affected my life. Em's unethical and unprofessional actions hurt me, my family, and others close to me. I brought with me whose lives Em has affected. If I would have pulled the trigger, my wife would have lost her spouse. My mom and my grandmother would have lost their daughter and granddaughter. Those who don't see, you don't see here today are my four sons who were affected the most. They lost their mother mentally and would have lost me physically. I trusted him with my mind, my thoughts, and my life. Instead of helping me professionally, she pushed me to attempting to kill myself not once, but twice within a 2-month gap at the same place of employment, all because of the mental game she decided to play with someone she knew was diagnosed as SMI. My self-worth has been shattered. She was my superior, yet she crossed boundaries. She was supposed to guide and teach me. Instead, she used her education and license to prey on me, knowing how unstable I was becoming. Her deceit still hurts till this day. When I think of what she did to me, I want to end my life just to stop the pain. I came forward because my voice has not been heard, and I want the truth to be heard. Many paint this picture of M as the vulnerable victim who did no wrong. No one knows the truth behind it all, because M refused to tell it. The touching behind closed doors in her office, house calls during work hours, the sexual gestures and comments made, $200 bottle of perfume, which she gladly took, over 12,000 of unethical text messages days and night within 4-month period. Because of M's actions, I am scared to trust anyone.
I have nightmares on the events that took place. I have panic attacks when I trigger from the memory of her. My mental health has deteriorated. My suicidal thoughts, depression, and anxiety are on all-time high. I honestly don't know if I'll ever recover. I'll have my bachelor's degree in mental health this December, and I honestly don't know if I'll ever use it after what's happened to me. I face charges on attempting to kill myself because of M. It's time for her to take responsibility for her actions. I trusted her. I let walls down. She broke my trust in those walls. Her actions have changed my life forever. When I think of M, I think of the betrayal and the selfish acts she committed. When did she get reprimanded for her actions? It made me feel I was worth nothing. I was nothing but a toy she could control. She turned everyone against me for telling the truth. The manipulation and games she played has forever scarred me. M is the devil and the worst thing that has ever happened in my life. M is a vicious, manipulative woman that does whatever she can to get what she wants. I have not held a job from February to July, not being able to provide for my family. Meanwhile, she's able to work, provide for her family, and hold a license to practice as if nothing happened. M used her license, her education, and experience to manipulate and control the very thing she was trained to protect, my mental health. I did not pull the trigger because the truth would have died with me. I want justice for what M has done to me. She needs to be held accountable. I don't want what I experienced to happen to anyone else. Please do the right thing. Thank you.
Thank you very much for sharing your story and coming here today. Do any board members have any questions for the complainant? Okay, no questions. So you can go back to your seat. We're now going to deliberate, and we ask that...
Sure, the licensee.
Oh, is the licensee here? I'm so sorry. Ms. O'Neill, come to the front. And is this Ms. McLellan with her? Okay, if you can introduce yourselves on the mic.
Anne McLellan, attorney for Ms. O'Neill.
Megan O'Neill.
Thank you. So you have up to 5 minutes to address the board.
Thank you, board members. I know you have an extensive file, so I'm not going to repeat. I would just point you back to the response we submitted to the complaint, as well as my cover letter that explained the situation. It's unfortunate that complainant has the feelings she does towards Ms. O'Neill, but to put it bluntly, those aren't the accurate facts. This does not involve a client. This does not even involve a supervisee. The complainant was a coworker who was not under the supervision of Ms. O'Neill. We strongly dispute the allegations that the complainant made this morning, as well as in the complaint. Several witnesses would also refute that. The fact of the matter is, it's unfortunate that there was a mental health situation in which a coworker made a decision to bring a firearm to the office to threaten self-harm. And even though she wasn't Ms. O'Neill's client, she wasn't her supervisee. Ms. O'Neill is the one who called the police to bring in help. She notified the employer to try to de-escalate the situation. And so we hope the complainant is still, she was always under the treatment at a different agency with a different therapist, never Ms. O'Neill. And so we understand the recommendation for a potential letter of concern to make sure there are workplace boundaries in place. Ms. O'Neill already took a boundaries course to show you how serious she takes that. But the reality is there's no violation in this case. It's a he said, she said, and it's highly, hotly disputed the facts. So we would agree to the board staff's recommendation. They've done a thorough investigation. And if you have any questions, we're available.
Thank you. Any board members have questions for licensee or her attorney? Okay, no questions. So we're going to deliberate now. We ask that you not interrupt. So like stated before, we have all the documents and all board members have read them. And just want to see if any board members have any comments. There's a clear description from both sides of what happened, and I just want to know if any of you have any additional comments on this case. And just a reminder, Mr.
No, I just feel like the letter of concern is appropriate in this situation because of how counsel described it. That's kind of how I see it as well. Unfortunate situation, but letter of concern, I think, is.
Absolutely. Yeah, the situation is unfortunate. You know, we hold the burden of truth, to prove the burden of truth, and also we regulate the practice of psychotherapy. And in this case, there was no psychotherapy. So I just move to move forward with the dismissal with a letter of concern.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you all for coming here. Okay, next item is 4D. Cases recommended for acceptance of a proposed signed non-disciplinary consent agreement. 4D1, Lacey Brown. 4D2, Michaela Landon. 4D3, Timothy Mullins. 4D4, Marie Tuller. Do I have a motion for acceptance of a proposed signed non-disciplinary consent agreement?
Palacios moves. Krieger seconds.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Next item is 4F. Cases recommended for acceptance of a proposed signed disciplinary consent agreement. 4F1, Melissa Vaughn. 4F2, Elizabeth Bedrick. 4F3, Michael Klinkner. Do I have a motion for acceptance of proposed signed disciplinary consent agreements?
Can I get moved?
Do I have a... Thank you. Roll call, please.
Annalisa Meek.
Aye.
Diane Palacios.
Aye.
Robert Charles.
Aye.
Christina Groves.
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan.
Aye.
Crystal Krieger.
Aye.
Jose Luis Madera.
Aye.
Mark Shen.
Aye.
Thank you. Next item is 4G. Cases recommended for opening a complaint and acceptance of a proposed signed disciplinary consent agreement. 4G1, Wendeja Moore. Do I have a motion for opening a complaint and acceptance of a proposed signed disciplinary consent agreement?
Palacios moves.
Madera second.
Thank you. Roll call.
Annalisa Meek.
Aye.
Diane Palacios.
Aye.
Robert Charles.
Aye.
Christina Groves. Lynette Hennigan.
Aye.
Crystal Krieger.
Aye.
Jose Luis Madera.
Aye.
Park Shen.
Aye.
Thank you. Next item is 4I, cases recommended for release from consent agreement. Items 1I, 1 through 6. Do I have a motion to release consent from consent agreements?
Palacios moves.
Madera second.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 Oppose? Motion carries. Next item is 7, complaints and other disciplinary matters. This is the time and place scheduled for the board's review of disciplinary matters. They will be heard by us pursuant to the authority given by ARS 323281. Those licensees on applicants or applicants on today's agenda received by mail a board meeting notice, which included a list of potential actions the board could take once we reach deliberation. This list is not exclusive, and there may be other options the board considers. Board members have reviewed all of the materials submitted for each case. The board will first hear a summary of the case from board staff. Once staff is done, other interested parties, including the complainant, if applicable, and the professional, will be given the opportunity to address the board. In order to give everyone the same opportunity to address the board, we ask that those speaking do not take time repeating information the board has already received. You and your legal counsel, if applicable, will collectively be given the same amount of time that board staff took to present the case or 5 minutes, whichever is greater. Once the board has heard from the parties, we will move into deliberation. We ask during this time that you do not interrupt, as it is time for us to talk amongst ourselves. If it is necessary at any time to refer to a client or former client, please use initials only, even if the client is a complainant. Please keep in mind that the board has a disability policy that prohibits disorderly conduct, and those in violation will be removed from the meeting. Before we begin, I want to advise you that this proceeding is being recorded. Accordingly, it is important that everyone speaks loudly and clearly, and that only one person speaks at a time. First item is 7A, Esther Cynthia. Is the complainant present? No. Is the licensee present? You can come to the front, Ms. Cynthia. Mr. Pritchett? All right. Thank you. Have a seat. And you can introduce yourselves for us on the microphone. Oh,
it's fine.
You're a little tall.
We're back in school. Good morning, board. My name is Jason Pritchett. I am an attorney at Radix Law. I am representing Ms. Cynthia this morning. Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Mr. Cynthia, I'm an LPC.
Thank you. So first, we're going to listen to a summary of the case from board staff.
Madam Chair, members of the board, following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation: ARS 32-3251-16-II, violating any federal or state law, rule, or regulation applicable to the practice of behavioral health as it relates to ARS 13-3620, duty to report abuse. Factors for the board to consider: from 10-19 to 10-23, client was receiving behavioral health services from agency while she was a minor. A 5/19/23 case management note completed by licensee included the following in part. Licensee met with complainant and discussed concerns regarding risky sexual behavior. Complainant reported previously confiscating client's phone to find over 100 inappropriate pictures of herself she'd been circulating, that client had been talking to an adult who was 32, and there had to be a criminal investigation regarding it. Client disclosed she was on a dating app and talking to boys and men. Complainant discussed client sending nude photos to teens and adults. Client had been talking to an adult where the matter was investigated under child exploitation. A 5/19/23 case management note completed by the licensee indicated client has given her address to men she meets online where they provide her with drugs, and these are the men she usually engages in risky behaviors. A 5/25/23 case management note completed by licensee included the following in part. Client's risky behaviors were a danger to self. Mother reported client informed her and complainant about her risky behaviors. Mother shared client tested positive for cocaine. Mother reported client confirmed seeing an 18-year-old and probation was going to press charges for statutory rape. A 5/26/23 case management note completed by licensee indicated licensee met with client, mother, and complainant at prison facility, and client went into a forensic interview with the detective. A 6/23/23 case management note included the following. Mother and licensee discussed the report of sexual assault and client talking to YFAC and complainant filing charges. Mother reported it was client's ex-boyfriend who broke into their house after their breakup and raped her. A 9/27/23 progress note completed by therapist included the following. Client asked therapist if she had talked about what happened to her. Client disclosed the story and the sexual allegation in detail. Client reported it happened in August in a company vehicle and driver told her not to tell anyone and gave client a vape and $10. A 9/28/23 CFT note completed by licensee indicated that mother and licensee informed complainant of recent allegations brought forth by client regarding sexual abuse. Licensee documented in a 5/19/23 case management note that there was informed of client's risky behavior, sending nude photos of herself to adults and being on dating applications, talking to adults, and even though complainant indicated there was a criminal investigation regarding this, licensee failed to take any steps to ensure the appropriate authorities were notified and took complainant's word that there was a criminal investigation. A 5/25/23 case management note completed by licensee also indicated that mother reported client was seeing an 18-year-old and mother would be pressing charges for statutory rape. Licensee failed to report allegations of statutory rape to either DCS or law enforcement. Additionally, licensee acknowledged on 9/28/23 becoming aware of sexual assault allegations that driver sexually assaulted client. Licensee once again failed to notify DCS or law enforcement of these allegations. It is highly concerning that licensee represents she did not notify DCS or law enforcement at that time because it was a third-party hearsay information. Despite agency being aware of these allegations and conducting their own internal investigation as a mandated reporter, licensee is required by law to report allegations of child abuse to the appropriate authorities. Even more concerning is the agency has policies in place requiring staff to immediately report suspected abuse to a peace officer or DCS. It appears on numerous occasions licensee failed to report allegations of child abuse or sexual contact with a minor spanning over a four-month period. And that's all I have, unless you have any questions for me.
Thank you, Ms. Zavala. Any questions for Ms. Zavala? No questions. Okay, Ms. Cynthia, you have up to 5 minutes to address the board, or Mr. Pitchett.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the board for hearing us this morning. We thank you for the update with regards to the allegations. We've responded with two different letters responding to a number of the allegations. I'd like to start and work backwards. The incident that happened in May of 2000, I think it's 23, was the first incident in which my client had firsthand knowledge of a sexual assault or sexual incident that required reportability. That came in through the probation officer and the mother, through a friend. At that point in time, she followed the policy and procedures of Southwest Behavioral Health Services, taking it to risk, and then eventually after doing a 48-hour investigation to confirm, that was then reported to the police department, at which time they were notified the police department already had an open case on that matter. With regards to the prior allegations of non-reporting through the therapist notes and the information coming from the probation officer itself qualifies as a peace officer pursuant to the statute. Statute allows for Ms. Cynthia to report that information to her. Seeing that information was disclosed by a police officer and a probation officer to her about the different allegations with regards to the client's use of her phone and the use of various drugs, those things were actually reported by a police officer. So for the police officer, for the probation officer to then turn around and shift the burden back onto Ms. Esther seems a bit egregious. Furthermore, when we're talking about the incidents involving her sending pictures, my client was only made aware of the fact that it was an adult, not a child, not a minor that those pictures were going to, once again, from a probation officer. I understand the concerns here, and this is a very serious incident. I would once again like to remind the board that the burden of reporting cannot be shifted. So once someone hears about it and then tells my client about it, my client follows up to ensure that that police report is actually been filed. That relieves her of that burden. I do understand that there are nuances and technicalities that come with the reporting aspect of these situations, meaning the 48 hours difference between when this was made known and when it was reported. We've talked about it with my client that maybe in the future that could be a simultaneous reporting. Her concerns were the reasonableness factor in statute and the fact that false reporting carries a felony claim as far as false reporting, and that tempered her desire to move forward with an immediate reporting until we got actual knowledge of what had happened. I'm open for any further questions.
Thank you. Any questions for the attorney or the licensee? Okay, no questions. Are you addressing the board or I was checking? Okay, all right. Thank you.
My last response to the board would also be if this is a situation in which Ms. Esther could benefit as a first time her being in this situation with the board from continuing education for some of those nuances, we're also.
Okay, thank you. So now the board is going to deliberate. We ask that you not interrupt.
Thank you.
And okay, there are questions for the licensee and the attorney. Ms. Palacios?
Ms. Cynthia, can you explain your understanding of limits of confidentiality when it comes to mandated reporting so that we can hear your understanding of what that is?
So essentially, anytime there's something that is a reportable offense, of course, reported to not DCS. DCS, when the parent is involved, and law enforcement, then DCS. DCS and the law enforcement when the parent is involved, and law enforcement when it's not a parent-related charge and the parent wasn't aware of it, then I reported just to law enforcement. Good question.
Yeah, just one. No, you're okay. Just wondering, just wanting to understand. So there's a statement also made, and I guess we can have this in our discussion as well, but about, and I wrote it down, about reporting. It's not our job as clinicians to know if something happened or not. We're reporting in good faith. And so even if we, you know, our job is to make the report, and then DCS and the police, they do the investigation to find out what happened. Our role is to, if we hear information, even if it's been reported, we still have that responsibility to report and ensure that it has reported, especially if there's not a report number that can be produced. So just wanting to put that on the record. And then also just one more question is you consulted with your risk management group as well, but did you consult with any other professionals, any other licensed professionals? What was your decision tree make model when you were making this decision? Can you walk us through that a little bit?
So the information was actually provided to me by a program director because I didn't get the call directly. Mm-hmm. And so she was the professional I consulted with. And then once we got that information, that was a third-hand report, like was a hearsay. And from that point, we contacted risk management, and we did staff it with the internal leadership team. And then after that is when the therapist who was assigned to these clients spoke to the member, got the information of what had happened. And
thank you.
Any other questions for the licensee? Okay, no questions. So now we move to deliberation. We ask you not interrupt. And Ms. Groves, you're leading the discussion.
Oh, I didn't realize that I was leading the discussion. Okay. I definitely want to find for the violation. Just kind of like to piggyback off of like what Ms. Palacio said, as far as like our responsibility as professionals is not to determine whether something happened, right? So if we have information that is coming to us, we're not responsible to go and do the investigation and everything like that, right? It is our responsibility to report it to the correct authorities, and that is their responsibility to do the investigation and follow up on all of that information, right? So it's important for us to make sure that we are doing that in a timely manner as well. So what I would like to do is probably do
Could
some...
I- Just stop you for a second. Is there any other comment about this case? Any additional?
Uh-huh. Yeah. I think just, you know, hearing from the licensee is she was looking to her superior. She did hear information third party. And, yes, she did have the responsibility herself to make that report. But it in my opinion, it doesn't look like she wasn't trying to do the right thing. Yeah. It was just like, I'm going to my superiors. I'm trying to figure out what is the right channel and work through those channels. But even in doing that, us as the holder of the licensee have that responsibility yeah. to make that report. Even if we're trying to follow protocol of the agency, we still need to, that's our license that's on the line that we need to be responsible for making the report. And if there's a double report, there's a double report.
Yeah, okay.
I would like to add that as I read through everything, how much information was being disclosed that hadn't been reported, I found concerning. Mm-hmm. I understand that there's like a hierarchy, but to your point, our mandate is an immediate report, and it wasn't just once. There were multiple times that concerning information was disclosed that wasn't reported immediately, and that was my biggest concern.
Yeah. And this is a very vulnerable minor.
Very vulnerable.
Very vulnerable and high risk. Mm-hmm. And so even though there's a lot of moving parts, but I do agree with Ms. Groves is that there was that failure to make that report. And like you said as well,
Ms. Krieger, is there's multiple things that should have been reported and concerns that should have been reported along the way.
I would also like to add that it seems like the licensee had some understanding of the requirement, but there were a couple of pieces that she was probably misinterpreting. And I think that that's the issue why she didn't report. So, I agree.
I also agree. I think some of it got watered down with maybe what the agency policy may have been. And just for the record, as a licensee holder, we want to make sure we're empowered to educate our agency to say, okay, this is policy, but this is statute, and this is my responsibility as a licensee.
Right. Law versus policy from agency. Mm-hmm. Correct.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay, Ms. Groves, do you want to?
Do I find for the violation?
You make a move.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I'd like to move to find for the violation ARS 13-3620, duty to report abuse.
So we find for the violation of 32325116 double I.
Yes.
As it refers to ARS 13-3220, duty to report abuse.
Yes.
Do I have a second?
Figure second.
And all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Oppose? Okay. And now what do you recommend, Ms. Gross?
I would definitely recommend some CE units, specifically on duty to report. I think that would be probably really important, as well as some ethical law and ethics CE units as well. I would like to do some supervision. I just want to hear from my board members on how they would like to structure that, if anyone has any ideas, just because I would like her to maybe have a little bit more supervision kind of in this area, to kind of have somebody to go to talk about some of these cases.
I kind of disagree because it just seems to me, but I'd like to discuss, it seems to me that the issue necessarily related to supervision, but more of knowing the law.
Okay.
But please.
I'd also like to add maybe a CEU of substance use and limits of confidentiality, 42 CFR, working specifically with minors and understanding what are substance use limits of confidentiality.
Kind of along that line, I had wondered about CEUs with working with high-risk youth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Do you also decision tree making model?
Part of the ethics, right?
Yeah.
They usually include that in ethics class.
I always like to just name that, though, because we all, as clinicians, have so many decisions to make, and it's so important to seek the consultation and from multiple sources, and so really following that model.
Mm-hmm. So, and how many hours for the CEU? So I'm thinking like
which
three.
Have? How many? Sounds like we have like maybe four or five different.
What did you have?
Duty to report, ethics and law, substance use and confidentiality, and working with high-risk youth.
I'd probably say like three in each. Yeah, it's quite a bit of CEUs. Because that's going to be a total of what? Like
12.
12, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And is the consent agreement for 12 months?
Right. I was going to reiterate. I just want to make sure you guys were
okay. Complete. Anything else? Any other comment? Any other recommendation?
Are we tying in the substance use CEUs with the high-risk youth, or are we going to do the substance use separate?
So I think that since it's related to confidentiality specifically for substance use, is that that'd be different?
Yeah, I would like to see something just because confidentiality and mm-hmm. release for substance use looks a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd like to see something of that in there, especially continuing to work with high-risk youth. Mm-hmm. This is going to come up, and understanding what point do we report when they're engaging in this behavior?
Yeah, I would agree. I think having it separate mm-hmm. would be important. So having something on the substance use and then high risk use.
Mm-hmm.
How many, where are we at? How many? I feel like there's a lot.
Yeah.
We might be overkilling this situation a little bit because I think the message is going to get lost if we have too many trainings. Like, what was the real issue that she wasn't addressing in this, right? So we're 12 right now. I mean, I'll be fine with 12, but I just want to make sure that we're just not kitchen sinking everything and throwing all the things that we think might be the issue, right?
Are there any CUs that you think might not necessarily connect with the case?
I don't even remember how many we got so far. I feel like there's a problem.
It's 3 CUs in duty to report, 3 CUs in ethics, behavioral health ethics and law, 3 CUs in substance use and confidentiality, and 3 CUs in working with high-risk youth.
So is that still a total of 12?
That is correct.
Okay.
The duty to report in the ethics and law, because that is an ethics and law issue, could that be bundled into one?
I think because that's one of the main issues, I'd prefer to keep those separate. If we were to put two together, I would say high-risk youth and substance abuse and high-risk youth.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, and see if there's a course that captures all of that. Because I think all of these are issues that have come up. Mm-hmm. And so is there a CEU that can capture that? And so maybe can we put that as a caveat, Ms. Zavala, as if she does find a course that captures substance use in high-risk youth, that can be consolidated.
If not, then she'd have to take 3 more?
That's what I'd be comfortable with. But again,
yeah,
I would have to take 3 in each.
So let me just ask if you don't mind. Sorry, Ms. Zavala, we're almost there. Okay, so the substance use is related to disclosure of information?
CFR.
CFR. CFR 42. Mm-hmm. Okay. Or 42 CFR, yeah.
So would that be part of
do not report, and that can get sticky and tricky.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so could it be one class?
Would duty to report include working with high risk teams or no?
No. Not generally. Mm-hmm. Not generally. I think we're okay with the 12 as we have it. All right. So what do you have?
We would be offering the licensee a consent agreement for 12 months. You'd be required to complete 3 CEUs in duty to report, 3 CEUs in behavioral health ethics and law, 3 CEUs in substance use, which includes 42 CFR, 3 CEUs working with high-risk youth. And if not signed, she'd be invited to a formal interview, and if not accepted, remand to a formal hearing. Would that be your motion?
Is there early release?
There's always a release after they complete all of the education, because there's nothing to monitor after they complete them.
Okay.
Yes.
Second?
Palacios.
Roll call, please.
Adelisa Meek.
Aye.
Diane Palacios.
Aye.
Robert Charles.
Aye.
Christina Groves.
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan.
Aye.
Crystal Krieger.
Aye.
Jose Luis Madera.
Aye.
Mark Shen.
Aye.
Thank you. So that concludes this case. If you have any further questions, you can call your investigator next week, and support staff will be contacting you.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Next, we're moving to case 7B. Jessica Reed is the complainant here. And the licensee is here. And Mr. Sharon Akins. So if you can introduce yourselves for the record on the microphone, please.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm Sharon Akins. I'm counsel for your licensee. I'll let her introduce herself, and then we do have some comments.
Hi, I'm Jessica Reed. I'm a licensee for counselor.
All right. Thank you. So first we're going to listen to the summary of the case, and then you'll have a chance to address the board.
Madam Chair, members of the board, following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation.
ARS 32-3251-16T, disclosing a professional confidence or privileged communication. This recommendation is based on the following. In 424, licensee provided one therapy session to client. On or around 4/18/24, client emailed licensee indicating he was hearing voices and was experiencing suicidal ideation. For licensee's 4/21/24 chart note, licensee contacted licensee's emergency contact and requested a welfare check from the police, but realized client's apartment number was not within his records. Despite licensee contacting agency regarding client's well-being, licensee notes do not accurately reflect that a phone call was made to agency as well as the conversation held during the call to the agency. Agency was able to provide a copy of the recorded phone call between licensee and agency staff from 4/19/24, which included the following in part. Licensee provided agency's client's name, date of birth, and phone number within the first 2 minutes. Licensee stated client was hearing voices telling client to kill herself, and client never reached back out to licensee. Licensee informed agency of client's past suicide attempt and inpatient history. Licensee indicated that we attempted to contact different police departments. Around 6 minutes into the recording, agency staff tells licensee she will need to contact a police to conduct a welfare check, and licensee responded, okay. At this time, and as an agency staff was ending the call, a male voice was heard in the background. The male voice asked if agency staff could transfer them back to Tempe Police and explain the situation to them since they are the ones who referred them to the contact agency. Agency staff asked who was speaking, and licensee identified him as her husband. Even though licensee represents that her husband was not present in the room while she was relaying client's personal information to agency, she admitted that she was not even aware her husband was in the room, indicating licensee, in fact, does not know when her husband entered the room. It is highly concerning that licensee's husband was present for a phone call regarding one of licensee's clients. Furthermore, even if licensee's representation that her husband did not hear any of the client's PHI was accurate, it is highly unprofessional and concerning for licensee's husband to engage in a phone conversation with agency staff regarding a client in any matter. Additionally, following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation. ARS 32-3251-16P, failing to conform to minimum practice standards as developed by the board as it relates to 1101 consent for treatment, 1102 treatment plan, 1103 client record. This recommendation is based on the following. A 3/29/24 informed consent failed to include 5 of the required board requirements. A 4/9/24 treatment plan failed to include 1 of the requirements. It is concerning that licensee has been independently licensed since 2/22 and fails to ensure her clinical documentation meets all minimum standards. Furthermore, in 10/21, licensee completed her LAC renewal application, and in 1/24, she completed her LPC renewal application, which required her to complete the board's tutorial regarding statutes and regulations, which specifically provide education and training on clinical documentation standards. Since being notified of the documentation deficiencies, licensee provided board staff updated practice templates that now meet all requirements. And that's all I have, unless you have any questions for me.
Thank you, Ms. Zavala. Any board members have questions for staff? Okay, no questions. Ms. Reed, you have up to 5 minutes to address the board.
Let me take the lead at this point, and I'm sure you're going to have some questions after we go through some of the basics of what's happened in this situation. First, let me speak to the deficiencies of the documentation. Ms. Reed certainly willingly admits that there were flaws and deficiencies in her documentation. To correct that, she's already taken a 3-hour, 3-unit CE on Arizona documentation and a 3-hour CE on the ethics and law of Arizona. Both of those provided by Patricia Dobratz, who's the former chair of this board. So we know that that education and that information was good and helpful. That hopefully should help resolve some of your concerns about where things will go moving forward. Then we have the issue of potential of a prohibited release of information. And there appear to be at least 4 people that that might apply to. The licensee contacted the client's mother, who was the point of contact and was the emergency contact. She then contacted at least 1 and maybe 2 police departments, and then ultimately contacted a crisis service center, the number of which was given to her by the police department, and she was instructed to contact that service in order to get assistance. in locating and offering services to this potentially suicidal client. All of those are covered under the HIPAA exception that we've noted in the response, and for the record is 45 CFR section 164.512J1I. And it does allow for release of PHI and clinical identifying information about a client in situations where that release may, in good faith, be a judgment call made by the clinician with regard to assisting or eliminating the risk of harm to a person, here, the patient, or to the general public. So I think that there's sufficient information there to indicate that it was appropriate for the licensee to reach out to those various four entities, if you will, in an effort to try and assist her client. I think if she was appearing here today after there had been some kind of self-harm by the client, if he hadn't reached out and made efforts to protect that client, that you all would be quite unhappy with her under those circumstances. So the one issue that now remains to be considered is, was there a violation here in terms of the licensee releasing confidential information when her husband was present in the room? She has maintained throughout that she wasn't sure when her husband came into the room, but she did know that he was not present at the very beginning of the conversation with a crisis service worker when she disclosed information about the patient. In fact, let me note that when she called the police, when she called the social services crisis agency, that the first questions that they immediately ask is, what's the name, address, and phone number of the patient that you're calling about? So it sort of sets the table for a licensee to assume, well, these are people that do this a whole lot more often than I do as a licensee. This must be okay. And indeed, the HIPAA exception suggests that it is. Now, all things being equal, there could be a real difficulty here in terms of pointing to any evidence that would support the licensee's continued assertion that the husband was not present during the conversation. There were two things that were noted in the investigative report that was used to point to that being a problem, that the husband was present when that information was given. One was the notion that somehow there may have been a speakerphone, or that somehow or another the husband had been there since the very beginning. Not sure. The other thing that the investigative report points out is that several times in the course of this recorded discussion between the licensee and the crisis service worker, the licensee used the term "we." Now, what I'd like to share with you is that at the time that we received the investigative report, that it was only at that point in time that we realized that there had been that board staff had obtained a copy of this recording. We didn't get a copy of the recording. Licensee didn't have a chance to review that recording. It's already past the time that new information can be presented to you. So licensee got caught short in terms of not having that recording to listen to prior to the investigative interview and prior to the completion of the investigative report.
Mr. Aiken, can you wrap it up?
Very quickly.
Thank you.
So when we realized that there had been a copy of the conversation obtained, we contacted board staff and said, gee, we'd like to have a copy of this to review. Licensee did review that and now has a clear recollection, based on getting a chance to listen to that tape, of when husband came into the room. And she has a very legitimate explanation for why she used the term "we." So rather than intrude on the time that we're usually allowed to have, I would ask that you be sure to ask her about these items so that she can give you a further explanation. And we thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Does anybody have any questions for the licensee or her attorney?
Yes, I actually have some questions. Good morning, Ms. Reed. Thank you for being here. I'm just curious, you run a private practice. Do you do telehealth through your private practice?
I do.
Okay. Do you ever do telehealth sessions from home?
I do.
Okay. When you're providing telehealth sessions from home, what is that set up like?
I have a private office.
Okay. Is that a bedroom in the house?
No, it's an actual office.
On your property?
Yes, in my house. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay. It's a room. It's a room within your house.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. And during those telehealth sessions, what are some things that you do to ensure confidentiality that other people in the home aren't hearing or walking in?
We have closed doors, and they lock. So that's what I normally do. Just to be clear, that particular evening I was concerned, and my husband was doing his work in the office, so I went in my bedroom.
Yes.
So.
Okay. And the other question I had in terms of choosing to reach out to the police department and a crisis team, what was your decision-making process on that?
I hadn't heard from him all day in response to some of my calls and emails, so I contacted his mom. Mm-hmm. She was the emergency contact on his form, and asked her, have you heard? You know, she said no. So in that point, I told her what I was going to do. She advised me probably not a good idea. He wouldn't like that, but I just felt that was the next necessary thing to do. So I called the police department on his emergency contact. It turned out to be the wrong jurisdiction. They gave me another phone number to another police department who they said they couldn't do anything because I couldn't find an apartment number. And so they transferred me to crisis.
Okay. Which that certainly can be frustrating when you're trying to help.
Yes.
And you can't get anywhere. At any point, did you consult with anybody else?
No.
Thank you. That's all the questions I have. If anybody has any other.
I do. Do you share an office with your husband?
I do.
Okay. So when you're having sessions, is he present?
No.
Okay.
No. Most of my work is done at my physical location office. So I work in a building.
Okay.
Outside of my home. That's where the majority of my work is done.
Okay.
If I do have a telehealth appointment, it's outside of my husband's hours from my home.
Okay.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
What have you done since this incident to ensure that like there would be no further breaches of confidentiality going on?
So definitely not making any calls from my bedroom since it does not have a lock on it.
Okay.
I did invest in the in session, please don't enter.
Okay.
I'm going to use that at home and at work. So.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
I do have a question. So you said that, like, you didn't know, that you knew that your husband was not there when you share information, right? And then I'm just curious, when you were on the phone with crisis and he asked, can we be transferred back to PD? So that's the question, right? How did he know that you had talked to PD is one thing. The other comment that I have is, you know, it has been stated that the first questions that PD ask, name and that kind of, right? So that's protected health information. So, if your husband knew that you had called PD, how did he find out? And if he was there when you called PD, then he probably heard the client's name. So can you clarify?
Yes, that? He was not there when I called either police department at all.
Okay.
And when I called the crisis department after I was advised, given the number to call this crisis department, he was not in the room. What was the other part of the question?
Okay, so when you were talking to crisis, right, and they were about to end the call, and then your husband, you know, came into the call and said, can you transfer us back? How did he know that you had called PD?
So there was a point in the call, in the recording, that gets very quiet, which is when I recollected that's when he came in, covered the phone. I told him, I said, I'm having a hard time, you know, reaching. I tried police. I have to take care of this. And she asked, she told me she was going to call somebody. And when I was on the phone with this, and then I went back on, and she told me, you know, what I need to do, that he can hear. Like, it's a cell phone, so I think you can hear something. When she said, we're going to or you need to call this number, and that's when he said, well, can you just transfer us instead? And at that point, she said, sure. And while she was transferring me, I was like, to go. And so he left the room. I got on with the final person who, you know, she took the information and said, we'll take it from there.
Okay. So you actually remember when he came in the room?
After the recording, yes.
Okay.
When I saw him in the room.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions before we deliberate?
This is just kind of like a question and a comment. As someone who works fully telehealth, have you had a conversation with your husband kind of following up with this about the importance of confidentiality and, you know, that when the doors close,
very
do
much.
Not come in?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So yes, ma'am.
Can I just state something for the record? In our portal, the address that we have in there that's made public is your home address. We don't have a physical location of where you do your work, so you may want to get that updated, just so you know.
I'm getting all kinds of – I got mail and stuff there from the board.
Okay. We'll look into it a little bit further, but that's what it appears.
Okay.
All right. So the board is now going to delivery. We ask that you not interrupt. And Ms. Krieger, you're leading the discussion.
Yeah. This one was a little bit difficult for me because we can't say beyond a reasonable doubt what her husband heard and what he didn't hear. I do think that it's a good reminder for any and all providers who are working from home to have processes in place to ensure confidentiality, not just for Ms. Reed, but for anybody. The other thing that was a little challenging, because it's not just the confidentiality piece, it's the documentation piece, which Ms. Reed has been very proactive. She went and got a training already. She has corrected all of her documentation, which again is a good reminder for all of us that the board has all of the resources for clinicians to be checking their documentation. A checklist has even been created so that we can ensure that all of our documentation has the appropriate pieces to it. And so with that, I've kind of gone back and forth of doing an NDCA for with 3CEs in HIPAA or doing a dismissal with letter of concern, but I wanted to hear from my colleagues what you thought.
I was leaning for the NDCA, and I was considering CEs on managing crisis. Right? Because obviously, right, it raises our own, you know, level of concern when somebody is, has thoughts of suicide. And there are times, right, when I see with this description of what happened, where the licensee could have said to the husband or to the phone, hold on just a second, right? Direct him to leave the room and continue with the conversation. But I think that, you know, dealing with crisis might be a helpful CE.
I think I would agree with that.
I also have CEs regarding providing remote therapy. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of courses out there now that kind of give you best practices for setting up a remote office.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if that training was provided, you could set up your office to where maybe you're facing the door, so if you see them coming in, you know. So I'd recommend at least 3 CEs of virtual or remote.
Would that be in addition to 3 CEs and HIPAA?
Yeah, I think it's two different things.
Okay. I'm good with doing an NDCA with the
crisis management crisis.
Mm-hmm. Remote telehealth, telehealth from home, and HIPAA.
I would agree. So we would be offering the licensee a non-disciplinary consent agreement. She would be required within 12 months to take 3 CEUs in HIPAA, 3 CEUs in managing crisis, and 3 CEUs in remote practice, in remote therapy best practices. If not signed, invited to a formal interview. If not accepted, remanded to a formal hearing. Is that your motion?
Yes.
Palacios, second.
Ms. Zavala?
Yes.
Do we make note that somewhere that she made corrections to her documentation, or we don't need to?
That's, it's part of the analysis. So in the NDCA, we usually will include that at the end.
Okay, that she gets credit for the stuff that she has done. Okay, got it.
When you say credit, you mean the courses she's already taken?
That we acknowledge that she has made corrections.
Yes.
Okay, that's it. Yes. So we had a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, motion carries. And if you have additional questions, just call your investigator and you will be contacted by staff.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Okay, next on the agenda is item 7E, Roberta Sadkowski. Is the complainant here? Where are you? Oh, come to the front. Are you the complainant?
CDE.
Oh, I just can't see. Who's the complainant?
The complainants are right here.
Okay. Okay, you can come to the front if you want to address the board. Ms. Maldonado?
Can I just go on record and note that I've worked with Ms. Sadkowski in the past, but it's been several years and I won't judge, or it won't cloud my judgment.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Shin. And Kimberly Kent, correct? Oh, never mind, Ms. Maldonado. So first we're going to listen to summary from board staff.
Madam Chair, members of the board, following review of the investigative record, there does not appear to be clear and convincing evidence to support complainant's allegations. However, following review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation. ARS 32-3251-16P, failing to conform to minimum practice standards as developed by the board as it relates to consent for treatment, treatment plan, client record, confidentiality, and telepractice. This recommendation is based on the following. Since 6 of 22, licensee has been treating client who was a minor at the onset of services at agency. On 5/25/22, father signed an informed consent, and on 6/3/22, complainant signed an informed consent. Both informed consents failed to include 10 minimum board requirements. Client's clinical records failed to include any treatment plan whatsoever. All of client's progress notes failed to include 5 minimum board requirements. Licensee represented she was aware treatment plans are required and she was busy and had a lot to take care of, which is why client did not have a treatment plan. Licensee acknowledged the other clinical records would fail to include a treatment plan, but she has taken a treatment plan course and moving forward is implementing treatment plans. Additionally, in 11/23, client turned 18 and licensee failed to obtain a new signed informed consent for client, being that she was no longer a minor. Throughout client's therapy, licensee involved client's stepmother in a session and failed to obtain a signed release of information authorizing her to attend therapy. Furthermore, licensee engaged with 2 other outside psychiatric providers without obtaining signed releases. It is highly concerning that licensee has been independently licensed and in private practice since 2016 and failed to ensure her clinical documentation met all minimum requirements. Additionally, these deficient practice forms are the forms licensee uses in her private practice, meaning all other clinical records prior to this board complaint would include similar deficiencies. Furthermore, in 2020, 2022, and 2024, licensee completed her renewal application, which required her to complete the board's tutorial regarding statutes and regulations, which provides education and training on clinical documentation standards. Additionally, following review of the investigative record, it is not apparent whether there is clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation. ARS 32-3251-16M, engaging or offering to engage as a licensee in activities that are not congruent with the licensee's professional education, training, or experience. Factors for the board to consider. Since 6 of 22, licensee has been providing services to client. Despite the family system being a focus of therapy sessions, licensee failed to devise a treatment plan which would outline the goals for therapy. In an 8/11/23 email exchange between licensee and father, father asked licensee for a suggestion regarding client's anxiety and depression increasing due to unsupervised visits with complainant. Licensee responded that she agrees supervised visits are necessary. It is concerning that licensee would provide this opinion without ever having any sort of direct observation of client and complainant interacting together. Licensee acknowledged not having any sort of education or experience regarding family law or the courts. Licensee also testified in court as a witness for father, and her progress note for the court testimony does not describe what her testimony consisted of.
Licensee represents she only testified to objective information regarding herself and client. It is concerning that licensee extended her boundaries of competence while acknowledging not having any education or experience with the courts. In addition, there was a supplement uploaded, I believe, earlier this week from licensee and her attorney. And that is all I have, unless you have any questions.
Thank you. Any board members have questions for staff? No questions. So can you introduce yourself? So are you part of the complainant?
I helped the complainant fill her public records and spoke with the investigator because there was a language barrier. So I was helping with that.
Got it. Okay. So Ms. Maldonado, you have up to 5 minutes to address the board.
Necesito no hablo inglés.
Are you translating for her, interpreting?
She doesn't have anything else to present. What the evidence that has been presented about covers it. There's nothing new to present other than what was submitted earlier this week. The licensee has not been reviewed. Ms. Maldonado is just requesting for Ms. Maldonado's part in this case, just to recommend e-training for knowing how to deal with family law, fragile adolescents, and grooming tactics and alienation tactics by one parent. It would be useful for her in the future.
Can she talk to us in Spanish? I mean,
I don't know. Can we do that, Ms. Zavala?
We need a forum.
Yeah.
I mean, I just like to hear what she has to. I mean, and thank you for talking on her behalf, but I would like to hear from her if that's possible.
So you're supporting, are you friend? Are you her friend? Are you, because you're not her counsel, right? Okay. How do you know her?
I mean, I just
okay. Are you a licensee? You're not licensed.
So, Madam Chair, a couple of thoughts. Just record, we can't do it in Spanish because not everybody can speak Spanish. So that would, we wouldn't have forum for that. I do think, Mr. Madero, if there happens to be questions that you want to ask in regards to it, I think it's possible we can get those maybe answered today. But I did just want to represent in regards to the supplemental information that was provided from the licensee, because the report and supplemental information does not get sent to the complainant, but what it was updated documentation.
I have a process question then. So when we have a complainant that doesn't speak English, do we offer translation services to come speak to us?
If they request it.
And then were you guys offered that? And did you guys not request it? Or? Okay.
It's in our documentation.
Okay.
It's also on our agenda.
Okay.
Okay. So we can move forward with the process?
That's up to you, Madam Chair. What I heard was that they didn't have anything additional
to add
what was in the record. So, but
okay,
I just want to make sure you know you have options.
So then for the record, the complainant understands that what she's requesting. Okay. All right. Do we have any board members have any questions for the complainant?
I have a question. Are we allowed to say what we're saying in English and Spanish so she can understand, or is that not?
No.
That's no. Okay.
Okay.
And just, I think, making sure, like, for the public that if somebody does need interpretation, that that is an option. So that's an option out there. So to ask if you would like it for a meeting.
Okay, so no questions for the complainant. Is the licensee here? Okay, so now if you can sit back, take your seat, and the licensee and Ms. Kimberly Kent can come to the front. And introduce yourselves for the record.
I am Roberta Zakowski, the licensee.
Thank you. So you have up to 5 minutes to address the board. Okay.
It's not accurate. She didn't have a treatment plan. She did have a treatment plan. She follows a very standard and strict treatment plan for her. And I'll let her explain that. But it was not memorialized in writing. So we take that very seriously. She has since taken a course and completed the course and updated all of her forms. We asked her why the deficiencies in documentation, and she attributes it to, at that time, she was seeing approximately 40 patients a week. She has now reduced her load to 17 to 20 patients a week in an intentional effort to focus on her documentation, written treatment plans, written informed consent. And I think that's it. So I think we put a lot of information in our response and our supplemental response. So I think this case would be appropriate for a letter of concern, given the fact that she has already completed the CE. And that's what we've asked. And of course, she's open to explaining her treatment plan and her habit and custom for a long period of time. She had very good training, very good supervisors, very good mentors.
Thank you. Okay, Ms. Zakowski.
Yes, I treat OCD as a specialty. I've had all of the advanced training that is available from the International OCD Foundation. And the gold standard for treating OCD is exposure response prevention. That includes completing a form, which is the heartbeat of the treatment plan, called the YBOT. Yale-Brown Obsessive Compulsive Scale. When the client completes that form, and I have one for every OCD client, they list all of the fears that they have, which are called obsessions, and they list all of the compulsions that they do to try to calm themselves down about those obsessions. We use that as the treatment plan for treating the OCD, and we do exposure response prevention the way I was taught by all of the seminal writers and leaders in the International OCD Foundation who've written all the books. I've met them all. I've gone to about 9 annual International OCD conferences. I've talked with them after their lectures. I've sat in on all of their lectures. I know how to treat OCD properly with the proper training.
Okay, any questions for the licensee? No?
Yeah, I do have a couple questions.
Ms. Krieger.
Thank you for being here. How often are you working with minors with OCD?
I have currently 3 minor patients who are between ages 4 and 6, so I work with their parents in the sessions. Mm-hmm. I know that you're curious also about the parental situation. I have no clients who have divorced parents. Their parents are fully involved in the treatment. And the only other minors I have are 12 to 14 years old, and their parents are fully involved.
Do you anticipate that you'll continue to see minors?
I will continue to see minors, yes.
Okay. What training do you have specifically in working with high conflict families?
I haven't had specific training working with high conflict families. This is probably the only patient I have had in the 12 years that I've been practicing that is a high conflict family. I have no others.
Thank you. I just have a couple more questions. Specifically for this family, who was present when you did the biopsychosocial? The biopsychosocial.
Memory going back. I believe it was just the patient.
Just the patient, okay. When you were obtaining a history, even outside of that initial intake, who all did you gain information from?
The patient is an excellent historian, incredibly intuitive and perceptive, and was able to provide me with all the information that I needed.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Any other questions? No questions? Okay, so this is time for the board members to deliberate, and I believe Mr. Madera, you're assigned to this case.
Yes, that is me. I am leading this conversation. So I am on the fence, and I don't know if any of the testimony today pushed me one way or the other. I was hoping it would, or an NDCA or an LOC, but I kind of want to hear what you guys' thoughts are.
I actually disagree because I do think we need to fine for violation of extending boundaries due to writing a recommendation.
Okay. Yeah. That would be an NDCA though, right?
A consent agreement.
Oh, consent agreement. Sorry.
Yeah, which means there would be discipline.
Yeah, that's. I'm concerned about that, the recommendations for custody. Another thing that jumped out at me in reading this is, and again, for the record of HIPAA-compliant ways to collect payment, it shows that there's PayPal and Zelle, and those aren't HIPAA-compliant. So that jumped out at me. And then also in paperwork, having something indicating in the paperwork of how to communicate with parents who are divorced. I know the licensee you said that she doesn't currently have that, but continue to treat minors that is absolutely a possibility, or parents that aren't together, and how is there the communication going to happen, and how is that going to be navigated? And I think a CEU on working with high conflict family cases would be helpful.
You're leaning towards disciplinary?
I am.
I think the comment that I have is that we're not regulating treating individuals with OCD. We're regulating the documentation, right? The things that were not there, like the paperwork, you know, not having documentation meet board standards. So I just wanted to make sure that, you know, we're not doing that. We're doing this. So I agree in a sense, but I also am kind of in defense for a non-disciplinary consent agreement. But I see that, you know, the letter recommending, you know, providing some kind of legal recommendation is concerning.
I think the reason that I would move more towards disciplinary is we have to consider the level of egregiousness. And when you're working with a divorced family, and you're offering recommendations. And that's why I was asking about how did we obtain information, because when we're getting information from only one side, there's a level of risk with that. And then when we're primarily gaining information from one side and then writing a recommendation in favor of that side, I think that there's a level of egregiousness that goes with that.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that's, for me, that's the recommendation. You know, we can't make recommendations regarding visitation, custody, things like that. That's what pushed me with that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Are we saying that we want a motion that we find that the documentation deficiencies and the extending boundaries of competency are true?
Ms. Saval, can I ask a question? Mm-hmm. So with this letter writing, Is it usually a DC non-disciplinary or?
The letter writing is going to depend on each individual case. I mean, we've definitely seen some much more egregious than this, and we've seen some a lot less egregious.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's really, you know, to determine, you know, based on the situation presented before you today with this particular situation. You know, there's some areas where the board is a little bit more equalized. For example, she's in private practice for 8 years and her informed consent is missing 10 elements. That's a big concern. And I could tell you that would typically be an NDCA just with that. You add on that scope that you guys have to determine whether there's clear and convincing evidence on there.
Mm-hmm.
And just also something to, and again, I'm just letting you know what your options are. Mm-hmm. If you felt that it was an issue in the scope and the letter writing, but you didn't feel that, even though it's clear and convincing, because it is, but if you don't believe that it rises to the level of disciplinary action, you could consider, again, doing an NDCA and incorporating all of the conduct, the documentation, and the letter writing as part of your CEUs in your NDCA. So, but since we have three new members here, I just want to be really clear. If you fine for the violations, it then goes to disciplinary. So now you need to just decide, does it rise to that level of disciplinary? Because it is clear and convincing. It's just whether or not you believe it's disciplinary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the letter is clear and convincing. Okay.
And I just have a question for my peers. When, you know, when I train folks or I work with folks and they do biopsychosocials, parents are always included. I don't really – that last part was where I was a little bit dissuaded in one way or another, because – even if we trust the child, we want to hear mm-hmm. all sides. And it mm-hmm. just sounded like there wasn't any input from the parents at that point. So I guess now I wanted to add that. Is that LMFTs that you guys know work with families the most, right? And probably work with minors probably more than a lot of us.
I will tell you, I always include parents in a biopsychosocial. It's important. Even if the child does know quite a bit of information, I always try to. It's extremely important. So it depends on the availability of the parents as well. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
I agree. I do want to consider the age of a child, because the client wasn't young. She was nearly 18.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's definitely a factor that plays into it. I think the thing that I'm considering more as an MFT is that any time that we are working with a family that has divorced parents, we have to be including and providing parents the opportunity to be included in that child's treatment up until the age of 18 when they become an adult.
Mr. Madera, which side of the fence might you be on?
Oh, man, where do we go? So I was hoping I was getting an easy one for my first case, but I guess I didn't get that. But I moved to find for both violations that were listed, which was the documentation deficiencies for ARS 32, 32, 51, 16P, and then do I just read the other one, all the ones below that?
Mm-hmm.
For consent, for treatment plan, client record, confidentiality, and telepractice. And then I also motioned to find for the violation for extending boundaries of competency, ARS 32, 32, 51, 16M.
Last 2 seconds.
We need to, what are the recommendations now?
Hold on a second. The next question is all in favor, but I think there was a lot of discussion on whether this should be an NDCA or not, I think you probably should pause and see if there's an agreement with the violations before you do all in favor, because it sounded like there was a lot of people on the fence.
Sure. Thank you. So are you guys okay with that? Could we do a roll call? Are you...
Sounds all in favor?
All in favor?
Did I ask? I don't know.
Oppose? Okay, so we'll do the recommendations now.
For the consent agreement, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In regard to the documentation deficiencies, I would say that, they already presented us with some information that they've already tried to do right by this and make the corrections. What are your guys' thoughts on possible trainings for CEUs?
I'll let the MFTs, because you guys address some good points about treating minors. And
well, that might be the scope, the next part, because I'm kind of breaking it down into the two different areas. So for right now, I'm just wanting the suggestions on how to the CEUs for the documentation. And then for the other one, we'll talk about what we would suggest, how do we help address those issues. So CEUs on documentation, I don't...
Arizona documentation and maybe even taking the board's statute course again. The tutorial. Thank you. That's what it's called.
When was it last taken? It says it was taken this year already.
Yeah, it was taken recently. I was going to mention that.
24.
Was that enough? Maybe it's not sticking. I don't know if there's something else you want to add to that beyond what she's already done this year.
Just to note, the complaint came in before that, so something to consider.
Okay.
So the Arizona documentation training and not the tutorial? Is that what we're saying? I think that's what I'd like to propose.
Yeah, she took the tutorial afterwards, hopefully.
Uh-huh.
That was helpful. So I think Arizona documentation should cover it. And also, we do have... the Arizona Facebook page that offers the cheat sheets. We have them in the front of what we need for our documentation.
So we're saying, how many CEUs is that?
The Arizona documentation? Three?
Three.
Okay.
Three.
Mm-hmm. Any other trainings or CEUs you guys think might help address this? I think the other one is going to have more of a discussion, but
I think that's good.
A supplemental piece corrected some of it.
Yeah.
So...
Mm-hmm. I did mention about the Zelle and the PayPal, though. I don't know if there's a specific training about collecting payment that's HIPAA compliant. I mean, it's probably just okay to speak that, but making sure that gets addressed.
Maybe some sort of training on, running a private practice, something like that. Does that make sense? You don't think there's...
No. But how would I don't know how, she's going to take a training on HIPAA compliant.
I don't think there's a training, but just maybe to make sure that that's corrected. Can we do that, Ms. Zavala?
I think you can just state it. The licensees here hopefully will hear it and make whatever changes are necessary. I think that's important to memorialize it.
Mm-hmm. You want to ask her a question?
I think that's a new nuance that probably needs to be addressed systemically.
Right.
About HIPAA compliant payments.
Yeah.
HIPAA compliant billing, right?
Name it on the record.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. So we're not going to recommend a training on that, right?
There is.
Okay.
I think monitor
just
that. Name it.
All right. And then Mr. Madera?
Yes. And now we're going to talk about CEUs or what we would like to see for the extending boundaries of competency.
I would like to see a training on working with high conflict families.
I agree.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is that also 3 hours? That seems to cover, right, the issues? Okay. So, Ms. Zavala?
So, we would be offering the licensee a consent agreement for 12 months. She would be required to take 3 CEUs in Arizona documentation and 3 CEUs in working with high-conflict families. If not signed, invited to a formal interview. If not, accept remand to a formal hearing.
Sorry, one question to my colleagues here. We'd mentioned about a letter writing and testifying. I feel like that just didn't get captured in what we're recommending. So before we move forward, do we all feel comfortable with that?
Could we maybe do some sort of
a bug?
I don't see it.
It's there. It's
there. There's a lot of professionals, but that'll help her if it's not true.
I would say probably maybe like professional, like competence, scope of practice, some CEUs in that, because there is very specialized training that does go into that type of letter writing and testifying in court.
Yep. So we would say like a three CEU scope of practice type training?
Yep. Yeah.
Ms. Avala, is that okay with you?
Just for clarity, there is, I'm just asking the question, there is courses out there in regards to specifically scope of practice?
Okay.
I'm asking the question because usually we wrap it up in behavioral health ethics, because usually ethics talks about scope of competency and not writing letters, et cetera, et cetera. I'm just not sure that there's one out there specifically on scope of practice.
Okay. Yeah.
So a training that addresses that you're ensuring that you're working within your scope, I guess, is what we're talking
about. It'll be ethics.
Mm-hmm. So we could do three CEUs in behavioral health ethics, mm-hmm. to include scope of competency.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Sorry, I know you were almost done, and then I added another one. So that's the last one, I promise.
So we would be offering a consent agreement for 12 months, three CEUs in Arizona documentation, three CEUs in working with high conflict court cases or conflict families, and three CEUs in behavioral health ethics to include scope of competency. And if not signed, invited to a formal interview, and if not accept, remand to a formal hearing. Would that be your motion?
Yes, Madeira motions. Moves.
Do I have a second?
Ending in second.
Okay, roll call.
Annalisa Meek.
Aye.
Diane Palacios.
Aye.
Robert Charles.
Aye.
Christina Groves.
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan.
Aye.
Crystal Krieger.
Aye.
Jose Luis Madeira.
Aye.
Mark Shen.
Aye.
Thank you very much. That concludes this case. If you have additional questions, call your investigator and staff will contact you with next steps. All right. Do we need a break? We'll take a 10-minute break at 10:38. Back at 10:48. Thank you. The board is back in session at 10:49, and our next case is 7C, Eric Rostamian. Is the complainant present? Is the licensee present? He's going to be on the phone. Oh, Mr. Rostamian, can you hear me? Hello? Is Eric Rostamian on the line? Hello?
Can you hear me? Hello?
Can
you
hear me? Yes, we can. Yeah, I can hear you now.
I think it was on mute.
Okay, so my name is Adalesa Meek. I'm the Board of Behavioral Health Examiners chairperson, and we're ready to address your case. Just want to let you know that this is a public meeting and it gets recorded. I'm here with members of the board, board staff, and members of the public. And so first we're going to listen to a summary of your case, and then I'll call you so you can address the board if you want to do that. So as we listen to the summary, I ask that you put your phone on silent, please.
Okay.
Thank you.
Chair members of the board, this matter comes before you today to be considered accepting.
Ms. Savala, you're on mute.
Fully on mute. Apologize for that. Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the board, this matter comes before you today for you to consider accepting the proposed signed consent agreement for the voluntary surrender of the licensee's license. The facts surround this is that the licensee was issued a independent license by endorsement from our board on April 1st, 24. Coincidentally, it appears that there was also a complaint that was in Illinois that was opened. And there's a consent order for 4/30/24, the same month that he received his license here, that his license was voluntarily surrendered based on a consensual romantic relationship with an adult who had been his client after treating said client for several months. With that being said, we do have a consent agreement for you to consider accepting for the voluntary surrender of his license that will have the violation of ARS 32-3251-16II being the subject of the revocation, suspension, surrender, or any other disciplinary sanction of a professional license. And that's all I have, unless you have any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Zavala. Any board members have questions for staff?
No questions.
Okay, no questions. Mr. Rostamian, you have up to 5 minutes to address the board.
Yeah, I don't know that I have anything to add other than all that's accurate. The client and I actually became engaged. This wasn't some sort of frivolous thing. This person had been my client for several months, and we ended the therapy and proceeded to have a relationship, which about a year and 3 months later, we got engaged. And then sometime later, earlier this year, I actually found her a new therapist, and that sometime later so that she could resume therapy. And that therapist, after she found out that she had been my client, my fiance, was the one that filed the complaint with the Illinois board. Anyway, I did surrender that license. I'm currently unemployed and having a difficult time getting a job. That's about it. When I surrendered the license, I knew I wouldn't be a therapist again, or without that license, you can't really do any sort of anything in social work or social services without a license. I didn't know, though, that it was going to make it difficult to get any job. I actually was hired a couple of months ago for a sales position. Again, sales, nothing to do with clinical work or being a therapist or working with clients in any capacity. It was a sales, outside sales position. They offered me a contract. I was hired. It was contingent on a background check, and they eventually rescinded the offer when they got the background check back because of the surrender of license. So what I found out is now when companies do background checks, it's not just for criminal background checks, but like anything negative that's online that potentially somebody could see. That had a lot of ramifications. That, you know, I can't get actually any job right now, that anything that requires a background check because of that. So it's not even just not working as a therapist or clinically. So it's a pretty bleak situation I'm contending with. At any rate, that's my situation. I apologize for any inconvenience to you guys. And I do voluntarily, obviously, surrender the license. That's all I have to say.
Okay.
Unless there's any questions.
Thank you so much for being present and sharing. Any board members have questions for the licensee? Okay, so there are no questions, so now it's time for us to deliberate. We ask that you do not interrupt, so you can put your phone on silent again, and this case is assigned to Mr. Charles.
Yep, I was going to have a question, but I think his closing statement, their understanding that his surrendering his license clarifies everything for me, that I don't have to ask that question. So 32, 32, 51, 16, double I being the violation that is in the consent agreement, I move that we accept it.
Madam Chair, I did say double I, but it's actually double L.
Double L.
Just for clarity. Thank you. That's what's on the consent agreement as well.
Okay, so that's your motion?
Yes.
Second?
Flanagan, second. Flanagan, second.
Roll call, please.
Adelisa Meek.
Aye.
Diane Palacios.
Aye.
Robert Charles.
Aye.
Christina Groves.
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan.
Aye.
Crystal Krieger.
Aye.
Jose Luis Madera.
Aye.
Mark Shen.
Aye.
Thank you, Mr. Rostamian. This concludes this case, and you're free to go.
Okay. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Take care.
And Madam Chair,
hold on.
Point out to the board members, because I think it's important to note that we received this complaint on August 21st, and the very next day we had a signed consent agreement for the voluntary surrender of the license. I just think that is staff needs to be noted that we take these types of cases very seriously.
Absolutely. Thank you. All right, so now we move to item 7D, Monica Scarpati. Sorry. Is the complainant here? Complainant does not want to address the board. Is the licensee here? Okay. So first, we're going to listen to summary from board staff.
Yes, Madam Chair. This complaint came in before our board on 8/17/24 in regards to licensee having a sexual relationship with an inmate. After the inmate was released, we have a signed proposed consent agreement for the voluntary the license with a 32-3251-16V, engaging in any sexual conduct between a licensee and a client or former client.
Thank you. Any questions for board staff? No? Okay, so it's time for us to deliberate. Mr. Charles?
And I would, based on 32-3251-16V, move that we accept the consent agreement.
Do I have a second?
Krieger, second.
And roll call, please.
Annalisa Meek.
Aye.
Diane Palacios.
Aye.
Robert Charles.
Aye.
Christina Groves.
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan.
Aye.
Crystal Krieger.
Aye.
Jose Luis Madera.
Aye.
Mark Shen.
Aye.
Thank you. Next, go to item 9, applications, please, and denials.
Madam Chair, since our last board meeting, the board has issued 243.
Wow. Thank you for providing all of those licensees. Denials, please.
The Counseling Ethnic Review Committee has reviewed the applications of the following individuals and recommends their denial for licensure. One application based on a failure to pass the required examination, one finding of unprofessional conduct, and one application based on a failure to meet minimum requirements, total denials of 3.
Thank you. Social work?
The social work academic.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Motion second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
The Social Work Academic Review Committee has reviewed the applications of the following individuals and recommends their denial for licensure. 11 applicants based on failure to pass the required examination, one application based on failure to take the required examination for a total of 12 denials. So moved.
Palacios, second.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. What do we have?
We have substance abuse.
Right. Substance abuse.
The Substance Abuse Academic Review Committee has reviewed the application of the following individual and recommends their denial for licensure. 2 for the failure to pass the required exam, 1 for the failure to take the required exam, equaling a total denials of 3. Palacios move.
Krieger second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. That's all we have, right? For denials?
Correct.
Thank you. Do we have item 11 A and B?
The we finance. Do not.
Okay, so item 11 A review July financials and August financial will be tabled. Next is report from executive director, item 12.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the board. Our FY 2026 budget has been submitted. With that being said, I believe the document was uploaded to the portal, the portal. But in addition to that, it's also on our website as required by law. So if the board members wanted to take a look at that, I will tell you that, I mean, it looks very similar to this past year, including our 7 new staff members, but there are 3 funding issues we're requesting. Actually 4. The 3 that we're requesting, 1 is for outside curriculum review for some of our more challenging applications that come in where the schools are not approved. The second funding issue is in regards to utilizing money to help enhance our current database. And then last but not least, would be to get new cubicles for our office. Even though we, everybody telecommutes, we have a hybrid. And our cubicles, I think, are from like the 1700s, maybe 1800s. We're just looking at kind of modifying them a little bit, as well as providing more space so that when our staff does have our, you know, meetings together, that we can all be here together. Again, that's a, we call them funding issues, but that means we're just asking for more appropriation next year, which is money that we have anyways. We just need to be allowed to be able to spend it. And then the fourth one is unique. We're actually doing what we call a supplemental funding issue to the FY 2025 budget. That budget has already been approved and has gone through legislation, but we're asking for an additional $90,000 because we are going to be required by January 5th of 2025, it's hard to say that, to change our website. We need to migrate onto a different platform. The platform that we're currently on is not going to be there after January 5th. So in order to us to submit for a third party to migrate, it's not just like changing a website because that's where all of our data is held. We have to like migrate over, so it's super expensive. We actually did a pitch, and we did all of the information, the stuff that we needed to do. We have selected somebody to do that, regardless of whether we get the extra money. And it ended up being $77,000 instead of $90,000. But I will tell you, if we don't get that supplement, it's going to be a little tricky to figure out how to make things work. But I think we can make it work with our current appropriation.
Thank you.
But you guys, if you want to take a look at that budget, it's not super exciting. But if anybody has any questions or concerns, let me know and we can put it back on the agenda for next month.
Okay, thank you.
Next is the discussion regarding the Auditor General's performance audit, which I thought we were going to have today. It was actually supposed to be released last Thursday, and the Auditor General was out of town and was unable to get that signed, so then it was supposed to be released yesterday. It becomes very public once all that happens, but we don't have it yet. It's going to look just like it did last month in on our executive session confidential, but this is where it will become public, and we'll need to answer to any stakeholders of any concerns they might have. I will just kind of share with you kind of what that looks like is once it does become public. I'm not going to say this and make the news because it's that good, but it will go on our website. I will make sure that we send it to our various associations that we work for. Or work with, as well as any other major stakeholders like the Human Service Council, the Governor's Office, just so that everybody's aware of it. So if they have any concerns, they know where to go, where to ask questions. Once all that happens, the next step that I'm actually already working on is getting support from a legislator, whether it's a senator or a representative, to support our continuation bill. So basically, if we don't get somebody to represent that bill, then technically we can get sunsetted and our board will no longer exist. Now, we all know that won't happen. With that said, it's not as easy as it sounds because my emails have so far gone unanswered of trying to find somebody that would help us. But my hope is once we get that audit and I'm able to send it to them, they'll see it as an opportunity for them to support something that the people of Arizona need to protect the public. Just briefly, a discussion regarding staff's involvement at the Southwestern School for Behavioral Health Studies. You probably have heard me say this for the last 14 years. It's my favorite conference. And the reason why it's my favorite conference is because there's about 500 people that come to this conference, and probably about 400 of them are licensed by our board. So it's an opportunity for us to really get in and provide education and be available. And it's pretty exciting because every year they do ask me to come and speak, which is great. We don't need to talk about them, but I did upload the evaluations from that presentation that I did Monday night. But more importantly than that, it gives us an opportunity to have a booth there that we are gifted. So, and basically we man it for 4 days, all day, into the evening sometimes. And all that means is we're not giving away candies or pens or pencils because we can't do any of that. But we have our business cards, and a sign that says who we are. And we find that people will come up and they ask a lot of questions. And sometimes they're general questions. Sometimes there are questions that are just in regards to their application or their license. So really a good opportunity for our board to be there. Ms. Knapp joined us for 2 days, and then our assistant director, Alma, and our credentialing manager, Zuri, joined us for 1 day, and I was there for all days. But it was a really good experience, I think, for staff to be able to be there, not just me, but other staff. And it made it easier this year because it was actually in Chandler. So usually it's in Tucson, so it's a little harder to get staff there just for 1 day. So,
if I may add, the comments are really, really, really good. I really appreciate the licensees that took the time to write additional comments about, you know, the presence of the board there and how helpful it is, and the information is very clear, and the, you know, the board is really open and willing to provide information and be available. So appreciate that.
Update on staff changes. So we have hired 4 new staff members. Remember, we had the 7 that we're hiring for. We've hired 4 new ones, 2 investigators, 2 investigative assistants. All 4 of them are starting on the 16th, so that'll be fun. And we are in the process of hiring what we call an IT generalist that's going to be able to help us with all of our computer stuff that will likely start here in a couple of weeks. And then we'll probably take a pause just for a little bit and step back and kind of reflect on what areas that we need to address before we hire other people. But hopefully by the end of the year, we'll have the last 2 hired. Just want to see where they're going to be best fit within the organization. Update on new logo. There's not a whole lot to say about it other than the only thing that you're going to see reflection of it right now is the agenda. I have no comment. This literally like happened overnight. I got an email like Wednesday night, and by Thursday, Friday, it went live. We went ahead and made it changed here just because it's been instructed to us that we have to make this happen. But we've gotten some additional instruction that I have sent on to Allison because there's a lot of font size and font color and font this and font that and all sorts of different things that we have to be changing. So I'm not exactly sure what that looks like, but we're going to have to do the best we can at making ourselves a little bit more making sure that the logo is there. And the part that a lot of people don't understand is a lot of the state agencies, they have like this 100 people over here making all these changes. We have 1 and who has a lot of other job duties and all that. So it is a little bit hard to figure out how all this looks like, but we're going to work on it. Hopefully in the next couple of months we'll be where we need to be. All of the other boards are in the same positions. But if you went to the governor's office or access or wherever else, theirs is already probably done. Mm. And they probably knew about it before Wednesday night at 8 o'clock. So, anyway.
Wow, good job. Thank you.
Just to add on here, I was invited to join in the Industry Advisory Council. And I just, board staff uploaded the email if anybody had any questions. I have not attended my first meeting, so I can't tell you a whole lot about it just yet. But basically, the University of Phoenix invites professionals to join their industry advisory council. And they reached out to me to see if that was something that I would consider doing. And I believe it's 3 meetings a year, 1-2 in person and 1 virtual. So, those are all of my updates.
Thank you. Any comments, anything else? If not, next item is number 14, future agenda items. If you have anything that you would like to put on the agenda at any point, please contact Ms. Zavala directly. Item 15, call for public comment. Those wishing to address the board do not need to request permission in advance. However, the board may limit those people speaking during this time to a reasonable number on any given public matter. In addition, each person wishing to address the board will be given 5 minutes to do so. Pursuant to ARS 38431.01H, the board can only take action on matters listed on the agenda. Action on public comment matters that are not listed on the agenda will be limited to directing staff to study the matter or to schedule the matter for further discussion at a later date. Do we have any members of the public that would like to address the board? Yes, please come to the front. And if you could turn the microphone on, push the little button. There you go. Now, can you introduce yourself?
Dr. David Harvey, and I'm a licensed professional counselor, and I'm trying to remember my number for signing in, and so I'll check it before I leave today.
Okay.
I'm old enough and still practicing, but it's the first time I've been to Board of Behavioral Health Examiners meeting, and I just was really excited to be able to do that. Obviously, I've been renewing my license for many, many years. I don't need to tell on myself, but I just really appreciate being here. And it's just, obviously, I'm touched, but I'm so proud of Arizona and the board. Usually, I'm not always proud of the legislature, but their support as well. And, what you're doing and how you're doing it is something that I really didn't know that much about. And that's why I'm here. And I know a lot more now. I appreciate it. And I don't know how much longer I'll be actively practicing. Mostly I'm doing consultation work now. But it's just an opportunity since I'm here. I wasn't expecting to say anything, but I'm grateful. So thank you very much.
Thank you for your coming. Appreciate it. Thanks for coming.
I'm going to turn this off.
All right. Is there any other member of the public that would like to address the board? Okay. Come to the front. Turn the mic on and introduce yourself, please.
Hi, my name is Denitra Gray. I'm a student at NAU. Also my fellow classmates in the back. We're just here. We'd like to thank you for your professionalism. We learned a lot today. As I speak for myself, I did. But I also have a question regarding one of the cases with Roberta Zukowski. If I can maybe ask a question about that.
We cannot address.
You cannot address?
No.
Okay, so are you able to give recommendations or no?
I'll give you my card.
Okay. Uh-huh, you can contact.
All right. Mm-hmm. I also want to actually state that it's good that you guys are here because it's very informational for those of us who are seeking, like, future licenses, licensures for our practices, and I wish that there could be something if you guys can address to come instead of, I know it's impossible for you guys, like the schedules that you have, but it would be more informational if we had these type of sessions that can kind of implement in some of our universities because of the schedule conflicts. I know that everything is virtual on the websites, but it would be good for some board members to kind of come do like a little presentation on some of the programs or our behavioral health studies at some of the universities. I don't know if that can be implemented in some of the universities, or is it best to have the students just come here to get an idea of what to expect on some of these board licensing board member meetings.
You have the best card that you could possibly have.
Okay.
To ask questions and reach out.
Okay. But thank you.
Could I get you to spell your name for the
record? It's Denetra.
Denetra.
Last name is Gray, Gray.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. So which of the other students want to make a comment to the board? Anybody? Any other student? Looks like there's a lot of you there. All right. No other comments. So next meeting is scheduled for Friday, October 11, 2024 at 9 a.m. at 1740 West Adams Street, Boardroom C. And anybody that may not be able to be here, please let Ms. Zavala know ASAP. Otherwise, we assume that you're coming. And do I have a motion to adjourn?
Palacios moves. Henning in second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, meeting adjourned at 11:17. Thank you all for coming. See you next month.